Good evening. It's good to be here. It's been, I think, about 4 years since the last time I preached here, so that's been a little bit, and a lot of things have changed, but it's good to be back. I'm especially thankful, and I guess I kind of have Scott to thank for this, because without meeting y'all 4 years ago, and without my connection with Scott, I wouldn't be in Davenport, Iowa right now. So a lot of things came out of our meeting 4 years ago that I'm grateful for. And even beyond that, y'all are participating with us in the work over in Iowa financially, and I am thankful for that as well, and y'all's partnership there, and I have a lot of thanks and gratitude for this congregation and for the support that y'all give us spiritually and physically, and the care and concern for the people over there. I've been told to tell y'all hello from several people that I know y'all know from that area. I've said y'all like 20 times since I've been up there. Sorry, you can't get rid of the South. I don't, y'all know where I'm from. So tonight we'll be looking at the book of Esther. And I'm not going to say this is the hardest lesson in the list, but it is the one that never mentions God once. So how do you talk about God's victories in the book that doesn't ever actually talk about God? You have to do a little bit of digging. You have to get a little creative and see where it fits in. When you look at the book of Esther, there's about three different, we'll call them episodes, in the book. There's three different stories that take place within the larger scheme, and they're all incredibly important to the narrative. You start out with King Ahasuerus. Chapter 1 of Esther, King Ahasuerus is throwing a party, and he says in Verse 2, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and the governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. That's a big party. 180 days of him throwing a party just to show off how cool King Ahasuerus is. This was all self-glorification. This was all, hey, look at all my stuff. Come into my palace. We're going to throw the party of the century because I'm the greatest king that's ever lived, and I can. And so he's showing off everything he has to everybody he has. And even he gets into, after the 180 days, he said, and when these days were completed, he gave for all the people, present in Susa the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days. So once he throws this 180-day party for all his officials and his nobles, he throws another week-long party for just everybody in the city. Poor, rich, men, women, doesn't matter. Everybody's invited. Huge feast. Anyone can come. And in another part of the palace, the queen is throwing her party for the women, right? You don't do things together. Men and women still segregated in ancient culture like that. Well, you get pretty far into this party, and King Ahasuerus has had a little too much wine. And he says, you know what? I've shown off all my riches. I've shown off all the great things that I've conquered, except for one. Time to show off my wife. Call Queen Vashti in here, and I want to show off this conquest of mine. I want to show off this great treasure of mine that I've captured for myself because I'm the great King Ahasuerus. Well, she's going to have none of that. She says, absolutely not coming. Again, King Ahasuerus has had a little too much wine at this 180-day party. He's angry. He gets mad, and he calls his officials in and says, what do we need to do? How do we handle this? They're no wiser than he is. They say, let's kick her out of the castle. We're not gonna divorce her per se, but she's not allowed to be the queen anymore. She's not allowed to come in to the court and be a part of the royal proceedings. He says, great, let's do it. And they said, let's do it one better. Let's make it a law. Let's write it in the law of the Medes and the Persians. So at some point in antiquity, some king had this great idea to make it a law that the kings of Persia, when they made a law, they couldn't take it back. Could never be repealed. that sounds like a really bad idea. But it happened, and that's how things operated. Once it was written as a law of the kings of the Medes and the Persians, it could not be revoked. So he says, cool, we're going to do that. We're going to make it a law that she can't be queen anymore. After these things, chapter 2, verse 1, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Party's over. He's coming down off his high. He's a little less mad. He kind of wakes up from this stupor thinking, what did I do? I got rid of my queen. I can't bring her back. How do we handle this? So he goes to his, you know, super wise advisors again and say, what do we do? Let's throw a beauty pageant. Let's do it. That's how we're going to pick the next queen. We're going to bring all the beautiful women in who are single women. We're going to bring them in, and you're going to pick the best one, and she'll be the new queen. It's a great way to establish, you know, royalty and rulers and things like that. None of this is good. All of this is just bad idea after bad idea. But Ahasuerus doesn't seem to have a lot of moral backbone. He's constantly, and you'll notice this throughout each episode of this story, he's pushed around by his advisors. He just kind of says, yeah, do whatever you want. And so he says, okay, yeah, sure, let's do it. So we meet Esther. Esther is one of the probably hundreds, if not thousands, of women brought in to meet the king. And there's a special proceedings to this. This is actually a year-long process. For 6 months, they come in and they're taught how to be women of the court. They're taught how to be nobles. They're taught how to be queens. And for the second 6 months, it's total cosmetics. Let's spend 6 months making them as beautiful as possible under what Persians considered beautiful. 6 months of perfume, 6 months of being treated, pampered, readied to meet the king. And then you have one opportunity. One opportunity to meet the king and prove to him not that you're a good queen, but that he likes you. And there's young kids, so we won't get into how this talent show aspect of the beauty pageant went. But you can draw your conclusions. Esther, being a Jewish woman, is brought in, and she just kind of asks for advice the whole time. She builds a relationship with the man who's over the harem and over readying the women. And she's constantly saying, okay, what do I do next? She asks his advice. She follows his advice. It says the other women chose how they were going to go about this. She says, I need some help. I don't know what I'm doing. And so she just kind of goes along with it as best she can. Now, there's a lot of question here, and I had a long conversation with some other students of the Bible and preachers and things like that as to how to really take this part of Esther, because there's some question here over Esther's morality in this, right? Because you compare Esther and her beginnings to Daniel and his beginnings. Daniel said, nope, not going to do anything the king wants me to do, not going to eat of his table. I have this faith. I'm not going to compromise that. Esther kind of goes along with what's happening here, sexual aspect and all. We don't see her or her cousin Mordecai really put up a fight. Maybe that has something to do with the story. Maybe it doesn't. We'll look at that in a little bit. But Mordecai, he tells her constantly, don't tell anybody you're a Jew. Daniel steps up. He says, no, I'm a Jew. I'm not going to do that. We don't do this. Mordecai says, Esther, don't let them know. Don't tell them who you are. Don't tell them whose you are. And we don't see her faith come into play within the first few chapters. Hold on to that thought, because Esther's made queen. She wins the beauty pageant. The king chooses her out of all these hundreds, maybe thousands of women. Esther's the best. She is crowned queen in Vashti's place. And that's really the end of episode 1. Chapter 2, verse 18, the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. Again, another party happens, this time in Esther's honor. He probably did things a little differently this time around. Verse 19 of chapter 2 starts the shorter but a key component in this scheme of stories. The second story is Mordecai, Esther's cousin, is sitting out in the king's gate. He's sitting there with the older men of the town, right? This is what you did if you were an elder of the town, if you were a man of good standing. You hung out at the gates. This is where the old men chewed the fat, right? This is where they talked about the news. This is where decisions were made for the people. Mordecai hangs out in this place. Maybe he's known among the community as a wise man. Maybe he's just keeping his ear to the ground, making sure everything's going all right. But he hears of this plan. Two of the guards are planning ultimately to assassinate the king and stage a coup. For some reason, they don't like Ahasuerus. Well, a coup might affect Esther. If the king's going to be killed, the queen probably is going to go too. So he tells Esther, he says, hey, there's something you need to know about. These guys are planning on killing the king. So she goes and she tells the king, and he finds out, hey, it's true. And these men are hanged, and Mordecai is honored. And it says in verse 23, when the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. This event that Mordecai saved his life goes down in history. The Chronicles of the Kings of Persia. We kind of have an insight as to what kind of stories might be in that. You look over at the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah that we have in Scripture, and you see some pretty important events to the life of the king written, right? Mordecai makes it into a book like that, a book that the kings would look back on for generations, theoretically, and see the history of the people, see the important things that happened to the other kings. This man, Mordecai, goes down in that history. And that's the end of episode 2. But that's an important part. Because in episode 3, starting in chapter 3, we're introduced to the main villain of the story, Haman. Haman is one of these counselors of the king. And he is promoted. He is given so much authority, he's basically the king's right hand in Persia. Think what Joseph was to Pharaoh, right? Over everything except for the king himself. That's pretty much the power that Haman has at this point. And Haman is a prideful man. In order to celebrate this, the king sends Haman out, throws him a huge parade, sends him around town, and this isn't like, you know, Macy's Day parade. This is a parade where everybody bows down and basically worships the guy. Pays homage to him is how Esther, how the book tells it. But that's close enough to worship that Mordecai says, yeah, not doing that. Mordecai refuses. Apparently, Mordecai is the only person who refuses. Because Haman hates Mordecai from this point on. Just every time he thinks about it, he is full of rage. He does not dislike any person in the world more than Mordecai, because how dare he disrespect me in front of the entire kingdom by not bowing down to me? Haman hates him. This is the kind of guy Haman is, and he is one of the most powerful men in the world. And he hates Mordecai. And so he overreacts. He goes home, he whines to his wife, which he does plenty in this book. He says, this guy Mordecai, he's not bowing down to me. He's not treating me with the respect that I deserve. What am I going to do about this guy? You kind of see him pacing the house, just whining to his wife. And she's more treacherous than he is, because she says, why don't you just kill all his people? Okay, that seems like a overreaction a little bit, right? Just kill all the Jews because you hate one of them. That's a great idea. So Haman puts this plan into place. Kill them all. So he goes to King Ahasuerus. And he words it very vaguely, kind of in a way that he's going to sneak it around him. He says, look, there's this group of people. And they've got these customs, they've got these traditions that they don't vibe with everybody else. They don't really go with what we do here. So they don't accept the worship that we want them to accept. They don't accept you. They're not going to bow to you. They're not going to pay you the respect you deserve. In fact, they could even revolt. We've got to stop this before it starts. Again, King Ahasuerus not having a huge moral backbone of his own and trusting Haman implicitly, gives him the royal signet ring and says, yeah, sure, do whatever you want. This seems like a big deal to not look into a little further. But again, Ahasuerus is a bit of a pushover. So Haman takes the royal signet ring, and he writes one of these laws of the kings of the Medes and the Persians. And he says, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to make copies of this. We're going to send it out to all the provinces of Persia, to every city, every citadel, and we're going to post it in this big poster, put it in the town square, and it says, on this day, on this time, everybody kill the Jews. It says, kill, destroy, and annihilate the Jews. All three terms. Completely weed them out. Everybody, regardless of your ethnicity, nationality, whatever, rise up and destroy these people. And again, written in the law of the kings of the Medes and the Persians, this is a big deal. It cannot be revoked. We're going to have a purge of the Jews. Mordecai sees the poster that's hung up in Susa, and again, a little concerned, goes to Esther. And here's the most important part of the book. Here is a key to unlocking everything. In chapter 4, in verse 12, or actually, let's go back up to verse 4. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed, told her the things that Mordecai is trying to let her know about. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed to attend to her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai and learn what this was and why it was. And Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him. And the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and command her to go to the king and beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and said, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law, to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king's presence for 30 days. Then Mordecai told Esther, and they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise up for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast with you. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him to do. For a book that never mentions God, this is as close as we get. Chapter 4, verse 14 is the key to unlocking the entire book. As Mordecai says, "For if you keep silent at this time, remember, relief and deliverance will rise from the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Who knows? Maybe there's a reason for this. As Jews, that reason, it's a reasonable assumption that he's talking about God's will. He never mentions that. But this verse unlocks it all. And Esther shows great faith in saying, "Okay, hold a fast on my behalf." Again, knowing Jewish customs, this idea was to petition God for his favor. God's not mentioned, but the idea of petitioning God is. "Go, hold this fast. Me and my ladies, we're going to have a fast. And then I'll go to the king. If I perish, I perish." Notice this growth in Esther's faith. She could have said this at the very beginning. "No, I'm not going to go be a part of this beauty pageant, and if you kill me, you kill me." That could have been how she approached that from the very beginning. She doesn't. We could argue whether or not there was faithlessness in that. But here, certainly, there's a trust in God. "I'm going to do what's right, and if I perish, I perish." Keep that in mind. Esther goes before the king and humbly invites him and Haman to a banquet. 2 days in a row. She invites him to dinner. They come to dinner. At dinner, the king says, "Okay, what is it you want to ask me?" She said, "You know what? Just come to dinner tomorrow and then I'll ask you." So we got two dinners, queen, king, Haman. Haman is stoked that he's been invited to this. I've been invited to a personal dinner with just the king and the queen. Man, I am on top of the world. He goes home. He's gonna brag to his wife about this. He's super pumped. He heads out to his house, and who does he see on his way home but Mordecai? And he starts pouting again. And he is tore up about it. And he was so inflated by pride. And then he sees this guy who refuses to give him the honor that he believes he deserves. And he's just got to deal with this. He already knows that he's about to kill all the Jews. But I've got to deal with Mordecai now because he's driving me crazy. So his wife has another brilliant plan. "Let's just build some gallows here in the front yard and you can hang him." Okay. Haman is just as easily influenced as the king is. And his wife has some truly horrible ideas. "Okay, let's build gallows." So they build these gallows. He hasn't built immediately, because the next day, as he's complaining about Mordecai again, he's rushed off to dinner. He's home, he's complaining. The king's servants say, "Hey, you're going to be late to dinner. You can't be late to dinner. We got to go." So he goes, he's again super inflated by the fact that he's been invited to dinner with just the king and the queen, and then the king asks Esther what she wants. And the king truly seems to like Esther, or at least appreciate her, because he says, "Ask me anything. If you want half the kingdom, I'll give it to you." Generous offer. "You have authority over half the kingdom." Sure. She says, "There's just one thing that's bugging me. Somebody has plotted against my people. Somebody wants to kill all of my family and my ethnic group. The king's shocked. Who wants to do this? I'm going to kill him right here and right now. And she just says, this guy Haman. It's kind of like the Nathan David, you're the man. Yeah, he's the man. This evil man Haman wants to kill my people. The king is furious. He storms out of the room. He gets up off the dinner table. He heads out of the room. He's got to cool off on the balcony for a minute. In the meantime, Haman's freaking out. Haman is, this was not how this was supposed to go. I didn't know the queen was a Jew. Whoa, what do we do? So he starts begging for her mercy, right? He's at the foot of the couch just begging for her to forgive him and to do something about this. The king goes back in and sees him leaning on the couch that she's laying on, and he misunderstands the situation. He thinks that Haman's making an advance on his wife. And he says, is he going to assault the queen while I'm in the house? We got to kill him now. And somebody says, hey, Haman built some gallows over at his house. Let's use those. Okay, do it. They take Haman out. They hang him on his own gallows. So then the queen and the king and Mordecai get together and say, okay, how do we save the Jews now? So Mordecai has a brilliant plan. Let's write another law. We can't get rid of the old ones. So let's write another one. And this one says, hey, the Jews are allowed to defend themselves. They can take up arms and they can fight back. It's not just going to be a massacre. At least it'll be a war and somebody's going to have a chance, right? And that's how they fix it. But we see at the end of the chapter, when this day comes, the Jews utterly destroy their enemies. Everyone who rises up to kill the Jews loses. Not a Jew is lost. And if this isn't reminiscent of the battles of the Old Testament, of when Jehovah is bringing his people into Canaan's land and they don't lose a single man in war. Do you know how rare it is to not lose anybody in warfare? That doesn't happen unless Jehovah is winning the war. Nobody doesn't lose people in battle unless God is looking out for his people. Again, God is not mentioned in this book, but the things that we see all check out based on the rest of what we know about God and his people. And to this day, the Jews celebrate the festival of Purim to honor this day when God's victory was won. There's no question that God won this victory. The only question is how. In almost every other book of the Bible, the curtain's pulled back a little bit. We see God working. Whether it's God directly coming down and saying, hey, David, do this. Hey, Saul, do this. I'm going to do this, and sending that message out through a prophet. Or the eyes being opened as with Elisha and his servant, and we see the angelic army surrounding them. Esther, that curtain's not pulled back for us. So how does God do it? How does God win this victory? Through people. Through everyday people. Two things stand out to me throughout the book of Esther. First of all, godly character and godly wisdom. At the beginning of the book, sure, we can debate whether or not there was good choices made or not. But by the time chapter 4 rolls around, you see some moral growth. You see Esther being bold and humble and trusting. You see Mordecai making good decisions. You see the goodness of Mordecai. When the king... I completely left out part of the story. I saw some looks. Yeah, y'all know what I left out. Let me backtrack a minute because I missed a very important part of this. I got going. What chapter should I be in? This is what happens when I just, write the story points down. So at the same time that Haman's mad, the king can't sleep. He's tossing, he's turning, he says, bring me the history book, put me to sleep. They read this part about Mordecai saving his life. He says, we never honored him. We gotta do something for him. Haman comes in, again, pumped up that he gets to go to dinner with the queen and the king. No one else gets that kind of invite. He says, how do I honor somebody that I really like? Haman thinks it's him. Haman's like, yeah, they're going to honor me too. That's what this is all about? Sweet. You should give me some of the king's clothes and the king's horse and dress this guy up real nice and parade him around town. Great idea, Haman. Go do that to Mordecai. This is why he's so mad before dinner. This is why the gallows are made. Sorry, I skipped that part. Because it all comes back around to Haman and his anger and Mordecai and his goodness. Because Mordecai is a good man. Mordecai is a Jew living in Susa, the capital of an oppressing people. At this point in time, some of the Jews have been let go back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple, and he's still living here. He could have very easily said, yeah, I don't care anything about Ahasuerus, go kill him. He could have not warned the king. But you see his goodness. We need to do something about this. This isn't right. You see him stepping up and advocating for a king that's not his king. That's not his ruler. That's not his people. Who doesn't worship his God. You see Mordecai's goodness. You see Esther's boldness. I think it's interesting. If you were to compare Esther's behavior in the second half of this book and the way that Peter in 1 Peter describes the behavior of a righteous wife, chapter 3, verse 1 of 1 Peter, likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. When they see your respectful and pure conduct, do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair, the putting on of gold, jewelry, and the clothes you wear. But let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. This gentle and quiet spirit is so important. The word gentle here, I don't love when the word gentle is used, when the word meek is there. Because meekness and gentleness hold two very different words. Gentleness is part of meekness. Gentleness is when a strong man chooses to be gentle. Or meekness is when a strong man chooses to be gentle. But he still has that strength. A weak man can still be gentle. The word, as I understand it, was also used of domesticating wild animals, breaking horses. My mom grew up breaking horses. That was kind of a hobby for her. She lived out in the country. She's been bucked, she's been thrown. She'll tell you over and over, respect horses. They're powerful animals, right? That's the idea of meekness. Power under control. The idea that we could lash out, we could do all this, we could fight, but you don't. And that's this gentle spirit that Peter's talking about here. Being able to do something, but calming yourself into gentleness. Being able to be fierce when necessary. Jesus did not lose his meekness when he cleaned out the temple, right? When Jesus, you know, throws over tables and kicks people out and is giving it to them, he's not suddenly lost control and is no longer meek. Yeah, I wouldn't call that gentle by any means, but he's meek. Moses is a meek man. Meekest man that ever lived, the Bible says. He was not always a gentleman. In fact, he stood between God and the people numerous times and begged God, petitioned God, and explained to God why he shouldn't kill the people. That's not a gentle thing to do. That's bold. That's brave. That's fierce. That's meek. This is the spirit that Peter tells wives to live with. A chosen quietness. An inner boldness. And the quiet spirit relates to Psalm chapter 1, the tree that grows by springs of water. It's not passive. It's not impotent. It's strong and deep and immovable. And when you look at those terms as they are, don't you see Esther? She knows what's at stake, and she knows what's right. And she says, if I perish, I perish. She goes before the king, and he accepts her. He loves her. You see Mordecai's goodness. And this is how God uses people to win this victory. Through them just doing what they're supposed to do. Doing his will in everyday ways. Not coming down and telling them to plan this big battle or do this big prophetic thing. Just doing what's right. And that's what's notable about this. They don't have specific revelation from God in this time and in this place. The way Mordecai and Esther save the people and win victory for God is in doing their best with what they have. And the most notable thing about Esther is that nothing really notable happens. I mean, yeah, we're talking about big world politics and things like that, but when it comes down to God's actions, you don't see the big miraculous. You don't see the sun standing still for hours. You don't see hail coming down and destroying the enemy. You don't see an angel coming down and just wiping out an army. You see people doing what people are supposed to do. The most notable thing about Esther is that nothing notable happens. People just do what they're supposed to do. Fasting is mentioned twice. To the Jews, this was inseparable from prayer. Petition. God simply answers prayers and works behind the veil, exactly how he does today. And this is how this story serves as an example to us. Because Esther and Mordecai live in a time like we live in. We don't have prophets coming and telling us how to take care of these situations. We've got a lot of bad in the world right now. It doesn't take much time looking at the news to see it. There are plenty of people in this world just looking for a fight. And there are plenty of people in the world who would just love to fight against Christians. There are Hamans in the world. And we don't have prophets coming down and telling us how to deal with those people. We don't have angelic armies visibly doing miraculous things. We live in a time like Esther lived, where all we have are wise mentors and the written word. And we do our best with what we have and with the time that we're given. Those are the resources that they had. Those are the resources that we have. And so to wrap this all up, how do we use this? How do we move forward with this, knowing that Esther had what we have? Knowing that nothing really special happens in Esther outside of the normal, everyday stuff. Our question has to be, what victories of God are you or can you be winning by just doing what's right? We know the will of God. We have his word. Esther and Mordecai had the law of Moses. They had the prophets that came before them. They didn't have anything right then and there. They had what they knew. That's what we have. We have the prophets. We have the law. Most importantly, we have Jesus. What are you going to do with that? And ask yourself, if you are where you are for a time such as this. You know, it's a fun game. And I've been asked this thousands of times. Maybe not thousands, that's an exaggeration. If you could live anywhere in any time period, where would you live? And we could think about that. Oh, it would be really cool to see the ancient wonders of the world. I'd love to live in this era, in this place. Artists would love to see certain eras in Paris or whatever. Historians, Egypt. Whatever. There's plenty of answers to that. But the fact of the matter is, God put you here and now for a reason. Are you doing anything with that? Because Mordecai says something else to Esther. He says, if you don't do anything, God's will is going to be done. God will bring salvation for his people through some other means. You're not going to escape. If you're quiet, if you don't advocate to the king, if you don't do what you know is right, you are not going to survive this. God's people will survive. God's will be done. You just might not have the benefit of being a part of that. And the same holds true for us. God's will is going to be done. Are you going to be a part of it or not? Are you going to be a part of a victory for the Lord, or are you going to sit back and possibly not survive? We need to be praying, possibly fasting. That's a whole different lesson. We need to be petitioning the Lord for his favor and doing what we know is right. And victory will not be far behind. Who knows? Maybe you've been brought to this time and this place for a time such as this.